Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. I welcome you here tonight to hear Professor Andrea Davies, who is Director of Research and Programs at Stanford University. She was a firefighter before she went into academia, and her history of the saving San Francisco, of the process of how it actually happened that people reacted to the earthquake and went about the process, has a lot to do with the fire. I think it got you interested in the first place, but it's also in line with everything I like to do, which is to take the myth that has been, you know, as all the details are eliminated from a picture over time, it's often very useful to put the details right back in again, because otherwise we think our time is degenerate. But once we see the details from all the times, you can feel usually pretty fine about your time. At least it's the same as it always has been. There was a speech the other night, and he was talking about the Eisenhower era and how the politicians, you know, did things and stuff like that. And some in the first row, you mean it's always been like that? So there's a little bit of usefulness to actually knowing that. And in this case, it's a great story. So Andrea Davies, the author of Saving San Francisco.
Thank you so much, everyone, for joining me here tonight. I'm so excited to share a bit of my new book, Saving San Francisco, with you. It's an honor to speak at the Commonwealth Club, which has played such an influential role in San Francisco's rich and unique history. And I'll talk more about that tonight. As a social historian, my book looks closely at the social world of 1906 San Francisco to give voice to the experiences and to the contributions of people who are so often invisible in more traditional historical accounts. In my talk tonight, I'm going to begin with a general description of the disaster and then turn to a few incredible responses to this tragedy by non-elite San Franciscans. And as I talk, I'll be showing some incredible and amazing photographs, not quite yet, that's my book that I'd like you to look at, but of 1906 San Francisco. These are to provide context to what I'm talking about, and every so often I'll stop and explain a few of the images. Before I start, though, I'd like to explain my interest in this disaster, which started with my experiences as a firefighter in San Francisco. I left my graduate studies at Stanford to become a firefighter in the late 1990s, and then, of course, I returned afterwards to write this book. And while a firefighter, I loved the experience. It was a physical and emotional job that really took time out of my own life, where I had to stop for a moment and think clearly and react quickly under a very stressful condition. Hopefully that won't be repeated tonight, right? But what I experienced as a firefighter is now the foundation of this book. And in the fire department, what I witnessed was how emergencies literally stop everyday life. And regular time stops for a moment, and the crisis takes over the lives of its victims. And as a firefighter, I walked right into these moments. And I saw the life that people really lived, not the lives that we prefer to present to the outside world. And here I witnessed the resilience of some in the face of personal disaster, but more importantly, what I saw was the ability of victims to recover depended so much upon the available resources from the social world in which they lived. Now, disasters big and small unhinged daily life. And while firefighting, I was struck by how individual emergencies eliminate what we take for granted and expose the everyday relationships and social realities that so often go unnoticed. The loss of one's homes and possessions, and sometimes family members, forces victims to grapple with loss and to imagine how they will rebuild their lives. But to do so, they really have to reimagine what they lost and then explain what that was. And if this is something that occurred with single families in it losing a single home, I wondered what a large-scale disaster would reveal about neighborhoods and cities. So now as an historian, I found that the 1906 disaster is really similar to those 911 calls. The disaster provides new access to the past. And for as much as this catastrophe destroyed, and you'll see a few pictures in a moment, it also generated new evidence about the people of San Francisco, from newspaper stories, personal letters, relief records, earthquake accounts, and photographs. And in 1906 San Francisco, the disaster forced residents to describe the social world that was lost and to define the community as well as their place in it that should be recreated. And it's from this view that I see the 1906 earthquake and fires as a window into the lives of people of San Francisco. Now, before I turn to 1906, I wanted to make a quick note about the sources that I use in this book. And I use the archives, of course, that preserve newspapers as well as personal papers of most of the influential San Franciscans. But I also thought a lot about where refugees fled to. And I searched the local libraries and historical societies all around the Bay Areas, even going to convents. And here I found oral histories, personal accounts, and sometimes even artifacts. And in fact, I closed the book by considering disaster remnants, or the objects that people grabbed in those panicky moments of the earthquake and fire. And I use these objects, and these are from people that didn't have time or education to leave us written records. I use these objects to tell their stories, and I describe the social world that many San Franciscans lost forever, but as well, I tell the story of how these disaster remnants became living documents of San Francisco's history. So now I'm going to turn to the 1906 disaster, and many of us in the Bay Area, and I'm sure most of us in the room, are familiar with this earthquake and fire that happened in 1906. It was very early in the morning on April 18th, 1906, 5:12 a.m. It was the first Wednesday after Easter, and the earthquake brought 65 seconds at a magnitude of 7.8, and it was a terrifying eternity to the city residents, especially those who were living over a landfill. But then sparks lit up broken glass gas lines that were scattered along the downtown streets, and flames escaped cooking stoves inside homes. At least 60 incipient fires developed into a three-day inferno. This inferno destroyed over 28,000 homes and businesses in the most populated parts of the city. This disaster left an unknown number of dead, and I want to point out that it's still unknown. It's been documented to a tally of 3,000, but most believe it's much higher than that. And the fires were intense. During the 3 days of fire, residents in Marin County, for example, could read sensational stories of this account, the fires that were still happening in San Francisco, and they needed only the light of the blazing city to illuminate their newspapers at night. The nation, though, not just the Bay Area, experienced a disaster through the many photographs published in every major newspaper across the country, all displaying horrific scenes of the $400 million calamity. As one resident at the time described it in a letter, said, "Think of this enormous city with not a single hotel, every factory and wholesale and retail shop destroyed, all the markets gone, and every office building and business block, 9 hospitals, every theater, and half or more of the homes destroyed." But the destruction of the city was not quite what it seemed when looking at an aerial photograph like this one of the disaster. In my view, this was not a mega disaster that wiped the city out in an instant. Instead, an on-the-ground view, one that I learned while firefighting, offers a different perspective. And for those that experience disasters firsthand, time really appears to slow down to make sense of a very shifting reality. And so I look at this disaster with a slower time frame, and I trace how the fires move neighborhood by neighborhood through the city. And doing so tells us a lot about the social makeup of the different neighborhoods in San Francisco and the more intimate experiences of those people who live there. And sure enough, if you look at it this way, the fires course through San Francisco's diverse neighborhoods, and it made very different experiences of loss for San Franciscans. For some, the loss was instant. This is a picture of a building burning either in South of Market or the downtown area, and temperatures could race as high as 2,700 degrees. But for others, there was time to plan. This is a picture from Lafayette Square, where residents could pull their possessions, go to the park, and watch the fires burning through the city and debate whether the fires would actually reach their homes. And I should point out here that the vastly different experiences started with the earthquake itself. In general, more working-class San Franciscans tended to live on landfill, while middle and upper-class residents resided on bedrock. I'm going to just show you a map here of the disaster zone, and you can see the area highlighted in gray is the area that was decimated by the earthquake and the fires. The fire line stops on Van Ness Avenue. It goes towards the Mission District, stopping near Dolores Park, and takes all of South of Market. And I'll make a comment on this slide in particular because this map, I think, is a beautiful map, but it was produced by the Southern Pacific Railroad in 1907, and it was produced with intention. And what this shows is it's very accurate. This is the disaster zone in the context of the larger San Francisco. And if you look at it this way, the disaster zone is quite small, which was the message they wanted to convey. But what the map doesn't tell you is that nearly half of all of the people in San Francisco lived in the disaster zone. I'm going to just walk you through quickly the 3 days of fire and talk about the neighborhoods that it hit. It started in South of Market, and along the waterfront and much of South of Market district was landfill. It was known as made ground at the time, and these were places where the city literally made ground out of whence was water. Ironically, they used the debris from the 1868 Great San Francisco Earthquake to fill in much of this area, and most of San Francisco's working class families and single men who predominantly worked along the waterfront and in warehouses in this district lived here. The fires raged in this neighborhood on the first day. They displaced all of the residents by April 19th. The fires moved through downtown and Chinatown. Chinatown was in the same 15-block area that it is today, nestled near the financial district. It was built on solid ground, but the fires claimed this area almost immediately. And I found documents to show that officials did little to stop the flames once they blew this way. Then the fires moved towards Knob Hill, Western Addition, and the Mission District. And the first two neighborhoods were a mixture of upper and middling class neighborhoods. Mayor Eugene Schmidt deployed all resources to save the mansions on Knob Hill, but this was to no avail. The fires then moved towards the Western Addition, and they were stopped along Van Ness Avenue with the use of dynamite. And that's another story of what went wrong there. But the Inferno was blocked in the Mission District, really more due to an effort of community-based firefighting. On the last day of the disaster, the fires moved back towards North Beach. It was an Italian enclave at the time, and it was nestled along the waterfront. And most of this neighborhood survived the earthquake, in the sense that it wasn't burned right away, but it was the misuse of dynamite in the Western Addition that sent the fires back towards North Beach, and this was wiped out on the third day of the disaster. Now, the diversity of neighborhoods in San Francisco at the time is an important point, because at first, San Francisco's catastrophe appeared to be this great social equalizer. It destroyed the city's fabulous mansions, the working-class neighborhoods, and Chinatown. And in fact, this was the most popular disaster story. I mean, didn't everyone at some point stand shoulder to shoulder with other refugees in a long relief line? But this social equality was a myth spun by the press and political leaders. And instead, what this calamity did was expose pre-disaster social inequalities. And those with the greatest resources not only were more likely to survive, but they recovered their economic losses more quickly, rebuilt their homes, and returned to the city at a faster rate. After the earthquake and fire, disaster relief, all $9.5 million of it, set the ground rules for rebuilding and repopulating the city. This was the first real national response to a disaster, and thus it was a chance for policymakers, both local and national, to test out new theories of social work that were so popular at the time. And although this new scientific method, as they termed it, was intended to be executed without bias, there were social biases built into the relief policy that favored home and property owners in San Francisco. And this new policy used middle-class ideas, really, of what a proper home should be. And that was both a physical and a moral structure. And these ideas favored the upper and middle classes, most often white, families of San Francisco, and put poor women, especially single women, and the Chinese refugees at a serious disadvantage. And this is evident in how the city was rebuilt, with the wealthy and the middle classes regaining their foothold first. And indeed, by 1915, the Panama Pacific International Exposition really showed that San Francisco was once again a thriving modern metropolis. But it was a city built with even greater racial and social economic segregation. And this started with a variation in housing losses, as I pointed out earlier, tied to socioeconomic status, but it expanded with this new relief policy, and then it solidified with rebuilding. But luckily, this is not the only story to tell. San Francisco's earthquake and fires created new opportunities. And the San Francisco that residents knew and loved disappeared during the disaster. And homes and businesses alike vanished. But survivors found that their beloved city was gone, and along with it, their familiar boundaries that defined their everyday lives. And so these barriers between public and private space were wiped out. And as you can vividly see in this picture, it almost looks like a doll's house, the top apartment over this business. It opened up new opportunities by exposing private life to public view. Some people were literally now seen in public space, and it gave them the chance to engage in public and political debate over the city's future. This gave new opportunities to women and Chinese Americans, and these are the stories that I'm going to turn to tonight. The fires wiped out Chinatown, as I mentioned earlier, and racial antagonism towards San Francisco's Chinese residents surely existed before the disaster, but these racist beliefs took on a different form after April 18th, and it's something that I call in the book heightened post-disaster racism. And this is where civic officials and white residents publicly worried about an uncontained Chinatown. This debate over Chinatown surfaced in relief committee meetings, in relief reports, in personal letters, and in newspaper stories. And city leaders pushed hard to remove Chinatown from San Francisco altogether. First by building segregated relief camps in San Francisco and in Oakland, and then planning to build, although they didn't, a new Chinatown in Hunters Point. San Francisco's relief camp was unsuccessful. The racist fears of some white residents and leaders forced this camp to relocate three times in rapid succession, and each move pushed the camp farther and farther west from the original Chinatown in the city. The camp started at the foot of Venice Avenue near the bay. The idea then was, well, if we put it there, they can get on boats at the bay and we can move them down to Hunters Point right away. That was moved quickly to the Presidio just inside the East Gate, but angry property owners living near the Presidio forced a final move to the western edges of the Presidio. But more importantly, the reason why this camp did not succeed was not necessarily its relocation so many times. It's that Chinese refugees refused to use it. And despite claims that the Chinese relief camp could house up to 10,000 refugees, it never climbed above 2,000 refugees as occupants. And even those responsible for building that third camp knew the reason. I found records from one camp official who said, "The Chinatown refugees were much dissatisfied at having to move again, and I think it's probable that many of them will not remain. They've been moved so many times that they have lost confidence and do not feel they'll be allowed to stay anywhere." Now, ironically, this racist disaster relief policy ended up empowering the Chinese community. In response, Chinese refugees turned to their local communities and international leaders for assistance. The Chinese disaster relief effort collected food and supply shipments sent by Chinese organizations from around the country, and they also turned to international support. More importantly, the relief effort kept a majority of Chinatown residents in the Bay Area, whose refugees found housing both in Oakland's small Chinatown as well as Berkeley's Chinese-owned businesses. Now, not turning to their own community was a dangerous option for Chinese refugees. It was lethal for Alice Sue Fun's family, who lost their Chinatown home and relocated to the segregated relief camp in Oakland. Alice's father died of typhoid in the camp, while her mother gave birth to her youngest sibling. Alice recalled later in the simple words, "Oh, it was hard then." Chinatown relief efforts brought political power to Chinese business leaders, and before long, Chinese business leaders convinced anxious observers that the catastrophe had not destroyed their community. And their threat to relocate San Francisco's lucrative Chinatown to another city altogether was taken seriously, and civic leaders agreed to Chinatown's return to city limits. Now, some San Francisco women took action to aid Chinese refugees, and this includes the well-known story of Donaldina Cameron, who ran a mission home in Chinatown for Chinese women and girls before the disaster. And when they lost their home, Cameron brought almost 40 Chinese women and girls through the city, across the bay, and into Marin, where they slept in a barn at a seminary in San Anselmo, waiting for their home to be rebuilt in Chinatown. And there was another missionary effort by an independent, almost idiosyncratic, really, Catholic missionary who lived in Chinatown named Ella Mae Clemens. Now, Clemens built her own relief camp for Chinese refugees after her own personal run-in with post-disaster racism. When she first requested supplies for some of the few remaining men in Chinatown, a relief worker told her, and I quote, "Dear lady, you can have anything you want, but we will carry the Chinese nothing." Upset by this declaration, Clemens demanded tents and bedding and set up her own camp. She used her personal property, as in the physical space of her home's lot, to create a relief camp that she named Dragon Hill. And this consisted of a missionary tent, four large tents, occupied by 20 Chinese laborers, as well as a chapel. And Ella Mae Clemens somehow managed to bridge the gap between white officials and Chinese refugees. Dragon Hill is the only known instance where Chinese residents remained in a relief camp inside Chinatown after the disaster. In fact, San Francisco relief leaders supported Clemens' direct supervision of Chinese refugees, and they sent her a steady stream of supplies to her camp at Dragon Hill. As one military commander wrote to Clemens, quote, "I am glad that the food issued to you for the destitute Chinese under your supervision held out for so long." Ella Mae Clemens' life was changed after the disaster. She found herself caught up in the racial divide of the turn of the century city, and she ended up falling in love and marrying one of the camp's refugees, Sun Yu Wong. This was in the late September of 1906. She mentioned in a newspaper article that, "My marriage will make me one of them. I shall know them from the inside of their lives, the side the world does not see." And although the local news stories made her marriage appear scandalous, Clemens did not lose her standing as a Chinatown relief provider. And from the perspective of white city leaders, Ella Mae Clemens' marriage may have softened the common association at the time with the danger of Chinese men. Now, Ella Mae Wong and her husband took up permanent residence in Chinatown. They rebuilt there. They participated in the tourist trade by running a curio shop. They sold Rolex from the 1906 disaster. They later developed their own tour of Chinatown. And the Wongs' business supported this post-disaster vision of a new Chinatown, one that accentuated Chinatown's difference from the rest of the city, but also highlighted a clean and respectable Chinese-American community. And their choice to remain in Chinatown may well reflect that the neighborhood still was important as a much-needed space of safety for Chinatown residents in the city. Now, the speed with which Ella Mae Clemens took action after the disaster by creating her own relief camp, that's actually not unusual. It's similar to other women in San Francisco. The devastating conditions presented an opportunity for many women. For example, middle-class women acted as volunteers. They distributed relief supplies. And as they care for disaster refugees, these middle-class women volunteers validated the need for their moral influence in public life. These opportunities also included working-class and poor refugee women who publicly demanded relief supplies. In these experiences, they are ones where women's activities are going far beyond the confines of the home. Now, out of approximately 400 residents in San Francisco, the disaster displaced 250,000. Out of this 250,000, at least 100,000 remained in San Francisco. And at first, they camped in the streets, on beachfronts, in parks, empty lots, in trolley cars, even voting booths. And it's not hard to imagine the level of chaos in the city after the disaster. And to compound the problem, there was no local. The fire chief actually died in this disaster, not that there was a disaster relief plan in place before he died. There was no local or national disaster relief plan in place. And as the American National Red Cross rushed to the scene and began to formulate a new relief policy, middle-class women had already begun their relief work. Now, hundreds of women immediately responded by distributing relief supplies and caring for refugees in the city. As Stanford student Beryl Bishop, who left campus to volunteer in the city, wrote, "The city needed a woman's touch. Quote, I was sure there was a large place of service in the needy city for a woman's heart and hands. It should be my labor to discover this and open the way for others who are waiting to help." Women were some of the first relief volunteers in the city, and as Red Cross relief administrators collaborated with local business and political leaders to set up a new relief system, they relied on these women volunteers to give support. Then official relief gathered momentum, and they built a total of 26 relief camps. During the summer of 1906, about 40,000 refugees considered these camps home. Relief policy segregated Chinese refugees, as I mentioned, but they also separated families and single men, and then relief dollars designated for rebuilding prioritized the families who owned businesses and homes in the city before the disaster. Relief policy was a complicated array of forms that devised a new scientific and not personal classification of need. And Red Cross experts argue that unlimited disaster relief created this unhealthy dependency. And so the goal was rapid restoration of pre-disaster social life. And the intention there was to spare San Francisco from a new dependent class of residents who were formerly refugees. Now, relief officials recognized that the canvas tents were not a permanent housing solution. So by the end of the summer of 1906, they built just over 5,000 wood frame cottages to replace tents in these camps. Now, this picture shows the cottages, how they were arranged. These are not just because they're being built quickly. This is how they appeared in the camps themselves. They were small wood frame cottages. Most had only one door, three windows, and no plumbing. Now, refugees were first asked to pay rent, and then they were allowed to relocate these refugee shacks, as they were known at the time, to private and public lots across the city. And as small as these cottages were, they were a privilege and not a right. Not everyone found refuge in an earthquake cottage. Horse stalls down at the local racetrack were another option. Refugees deemed incapable of self-care was a term, or moral health, another term, were sent to the Ingleside Model Camp, where they slept in renovated horse stalls, ate in a common mess hall, and worked for small wages, which was mandatory. Now, refugees could not choose their homes, but they depended on the favorable opinions of relief investigators. And Ingleside ended up becoming the home for many aging women without children or extended families to care for them. Now, I found new evidence in my research of the refugee women's experiences in these relief camps. And inside the camps, the commanders really controlled the fate, or at least access to funds, for the refugees. And many women turned to someone more influential than they were for help. Often it was a personal relationship, maybe with a middle-class woman volunteer, who I mentioned, or with a camp commander himself, and this was their only access to aid. Or it was their only way of being avoiding being sent to Ingleside. But not all refugee women politely asked for help. Others demanded it and protested the biased relief system altogether. I'm going to talk about both now. The support of a camp commander was not simply a matter of making life easier in the congested camps. Their futures depended on it. Women, especially single women, needed an advocate in the relief system. A Miss Sheehan gained access to aid once her camp commander acted on her behalf. He argued in a letter, quote, that her case be taken up if on no other grounds than a priority application. He argued that she was a real good-hearted woman, even though the single Irish refugee came across as, quote, very hard to handle, as she always has feels that somebody meant other than what they really said. Even hard-working mothers needed assistance gaining visibility in this new relief system. Application for rehabilitation filed weeks ago and nothing done, read another report by Allie Bailey's camp commander. With her son suffering from tuberculosis and her daughter-in-law with a baby on her hands, Bailey continued to work, quote, on and off at whatever her parents allowed her to apply for. But it was the camp commander's character assessment that was her most important part of this report. Two simple words guaranteed Allie Bailey financial aid from the relief system. The words, is deserving. The fear of Camp Ingleside loomed large for many older refugee women. Mrs. Coleman, a refugee slated for life at Camp Ingleside, reached out to a local club woman for help. "She is unfortunate and in great distress," the club woman wrote on Coleman's behalf. "She does not want to be sent to the house at Ingleside, and I do not blame her, as I know the conditions that exist there, and no self-respecting person could endure it." Now, Nellie Spreckles, yes, from the San Francisco Spreckles family, her brother was a prominent relief administrator at the time. She wrote to James Phelan and said, "Loosen up on that relief fund." And she asked him to give $500 to her friend's former cook. She wrote, "I think she would not want to go to Ingleside. I would not advise sending her, as she would keep everyone out there stirred up. She is such an excitable creature. Her influence would be bad." Okay, the letter is funny, but what Nellie Spreckles is talking about was a very real threat, that of female protest. In fact, it was so real that the camp commander that I quoted in some of these letters, who is very sympathetic to the refugees in his camp, started carrying a walking cane and a handgun for personal protection. So the Power Women's protest was well known in 1906, and one of the best examples of female protest is that of Mary Kelly. I found a picture of her here where she's standing in one of the relief cottages I mentioned with one of, this is just one, I can't believe there's only one picture, image in this picture, but one of her many protest signs. For Kelly and many other women, the disaster was a politicizing event. She was a working class mother with an invalid husband, and Kelly lost both her home and her employment. She was a cleaning woman at St. Ignatius in the fires. She was living in a relief camp in Jefferson Square, and here Kelly noticed that the new relief policy was not fair. Kelly vowed, quote, "to fight for the cause of justice and right, come what would, even though it might cost me my life." She started with a protest over food supplies. Fed up with long lines and inadequate rations, she led about 100 disgruntled refugee women to relief headquarters, and they demanded flour. This was a decisive and very quick victory. The women left with 50 bags of flour. Relief officials were relieved. They thought there would be the end of it. And then within days, this success for the women inspired an even bigger event known in San Francisco as the Flour Riot. Here, angry women stormed the main relief warehouse and made off with 2,000 pounds of flour. Now, the captain in charge of the warehouse at the time was accused and then convicted of battery during the riot. And what's significant here is that the rioting women were not just demanding flour to bake bread in their own homes or their relief camps. They were critiquing a relief system that denied them direct access to the donated supplies and money sent to San Francisco. And they argued that the flour and the relief funds were rightfully theirs as earthquake refugees and as American citizens. So these protests continued throughout the summer. Of course, this is not the end of Mary Kelly. I'll tell you more. And this built into a showdown over the relief cottages. In October 1906, Kelly laid claim to several earthquake cottages, and she gave them, well, she didn't have them to begin with, but then she gave them to needy refugee women who were excluded from this new relief system. And this, of course, included herself. Now, you won't be surprised that Mary Kelly was well known by relief officials by this time. And she objected to the policies that reserved these cottages for so-called deserving refugees while relegating other refugees to the leaky tents, she had one, or the cramped horse stalls, she wasn't there yet. She also objected to the practice of charging rent for the cottages. After all, she argued, refugees should control the donations sent to San Francisco on their behalf. So Mary Kelly's cottage possession really challenged a relief policy that determined which refugee women had a right to create home. And the relief officials fought back, and they tried to silence both the person, Mary Kelly, and the place, her cottage. They issued an eviction notice for Mary Kelly. She ignored it. A month went by. She was living in her cottage with protest banners in the windows for about a month into mid-November. And then relief officials fought back again, and they slated her cottage for transportation to Ingleside Model Camp. So when a group of 10 men arrived to put that shack on the back of a hay wagon, it looked something like this, which was the common way to transport these wagons throughout the city. Mary Kelly refused to leave it, and so she stayed inside to defend her home as they put it on the hay wagon and drove it to Ingleside. Now, you have to remember that she has protest banners in her windows, and more than one newspaper account quotes her as leaning out the back of the window as it's driving through the city, and she calls out to the crowd saying, "I'll stay with this house if they take it to the ends of the earth." Okay, so she does make it down to Ingleside. That's a distant shot of Ingleside. But when she gets there, the camp commander refuses to open the gates. And as luck would have it, it's the same camp commander that was at the flower riots where he was landed in jail. He refused to accommodate Kelly and wanted her to leave the cottage and left the gates closed. It was a 3-day standoff. At the end of the third day, the commander ordered that cottage be destroyed to put the end to it. And so even as that cottage sat still on the back of the hay wagon, Mary Kelly was inside it, and they destroyed the cabin. But what's important about this story is that Mary Kelly refused to give up. And in her account, she picked up a few of the remaining floorboards. She walked back to Jefferson Square, where she says she, quote, still had that leaky tent. Now, Kelly won the part of the cottage battle. This is a shot of Jefferson Square. Kelly won part of the cottage battle when Mayor Eugene Schmidt ended the policy of charging rent for the cottages. And then Kelly continued her passionate protest. She helped organize a refugee protest group called the United Refugees. They lobbied both the state legislature and the National Red Cross for relief policy changes. But more importantly, Kelly's work in the public sphere did not end with disaster relief. Instead, she transferred her passion for relief protest into politics. Before the catastrophe, she was one of thousands of working-class women working to pay her rent for her family's flat. But after the disaster, the politicized Mary Kelly worked tirelessly for reform. She registered to vote when California won state suffrage in 1911, and she was very active in city politics for the rest of her life. Now, my focus tonight on the stories of opportunity and survival during the disaster does not diminish the hardships that were faced by so many in San Francisco. The discrimination faced by San Francisco's Chinese refugees was undeniably atrocious. But that very discrimination is something that increased the political power of Chinese business leaders in San Francisco, and their relief efforts generated additional economic and political leverage and made Chinatown a permanent part of San Francisco's future. The devastating conditions presented an opportunity for women as well, from middle-class women who worked as volunteers to poor refugee women demanding relief supplies. Post-disaster San Francisco was one where women's activities were decidedly public ones. And women's disaster relief work, too, crossed class barriers, if you think about it, and it brought them in personal contact with the plight of their working-class sisters. And I believe that relief work strengthened these networks, and it gave women real work experience in the disaster zone. They continued their involvement in local politics throughout the rebuilding period, and they were part of the statewide movement for women's suffrage, winning the vote in 1911, which was well before the 19th Amendment in 1920. Now, undoubtedly, Chinese residents and poorer women found it harder to recover their place in the city, but they did not find it impossible. And more importantly, they took an active role in determining how the disaster shaped their lives. Think about the case of Mary Kelly and how the disaster gave some women not simply temporary access to the public realm. Instead, the disaster afforded them a newfound power in political life. The 1906 disaster reminds us that unexpected opportunities, especially the potential for both individual and social change, can be found in times of catastrophic loss. So thank you for coming tonight, and I'll take some questions.
I'd like to remind our audiences online on the radio that you're listening to Andrea Davies, the author of Saving San Francisco, discussing the aftermath of the earthquake in 1906. One question that I have is, you say how this disaster created opportunities and that the Chinese reacted in a way which actually helped them in the long run and so on. What was it about San Francisco that made that possible? Because a lot of times after disasters, there is, the same kind of discriminatory help. But no real advantages gained. The same thing is, was there something about the culture of San Francisco that allowed this to become valuable?
Well, what was fun about doing this project on San Francisco is San Francisco is a unique place. whether you look at it today or you look at it historically. And part of its origins as an instant city that grew so quickly with the gold rush and bringing in a very different type of social setting. And the city exploded so rapidly in those first few years, so that by 1906, there are distinct neighborhoods that have strong community bases. And while the overall story in my book is not that positive, you know, the powers that be do win out, but there's these pockets of opportunity for different groups to realize something more in the public realm. And it's really because of who they were or the communities they had before the disaster.
Questions?
During your research, did you uncover much about General Funston coming back from the Philippines and kind of taking over the place of the fire chief that had had perished during the earthquake? Because I hear all sorts of things that his rogue leadership kind of claimed a lot of damage that you alluded to with the North Beach disaster there with the use of dynamite.
Well, part of what was fortunate about this disaster, if you think about it, professional fire departments are new in the U.S. They really only started in the late 19th century. And in San Francisco, there were 575 firefighters employed at the time and on duty that day. So that any disaster would have overwhelmed any fire department, particularly in San Francisco. And it's fortunate that the military base was so close in the Presidio and Funston was there. And so I think to his credit, he brought crews in or military crews into the city immediately to execute relief. But the problem was without a department chief alive in the city, there was no central command. So it was partly Funston, it was partly Mayor Schmidt, but it was mixed messages. And here I'm speaking as a firefighter. It was mixed messages. The alarm system was out. It was neighborhood by neighborhood, and no one really knew who was in charge. So I know there are... So I'm in my book, I focus less on Funston, and I'm less willing to credit one person as being a failure for response and more realistic in that it was impossible conditions without water resources, no disaster plan, and everyone working in action. And actually, it was partly the Navy coming in and doing work by pumping water from the bay that put out most of the fire.
Yes, I want to ask, were the main authors of this discriminatory policy, were they the mayor? Rather than, you know, the military, or are they acting together? The policies you talked about.
Yeah. Well, you bring up two interesting things in your question. One is San Francisco politics at the time, which are a little bit quirky. And so it was a Union Labor Party mayor supported by the unions. And then there was a push in the progressive era for a different viewpoint of city business leaders and other politicians that wanted a different type of government. So there was a political battle going on at the time to oust the mayor. And what happened for the mayor during the disaster is he looked fabulous. He rose to the occasion. So there was that political battle happening that you briefly mentioned. But something different's happening entirely, which is this is the first time that the nation has a chance to respond to a major local calamity. And the debate that I describe in my book is not a political one, but it's really one about relief. And it's some of the questions that we still have today after Katrina, which is how to provide immediate care, when does that end, who qualifies, you know, and when should disaster survivors really be put out on their own? So these kinds of issues are coming up, and I find it so interesting because I'm a historian, because it's right in the middle of this time period where a lot of educated Americans are struggling with this great divide between rich and poor and a major flux of immigration all around industrialization.
Hi. I have a two-part question, but I don't want to be greedy, so I'm just going to ask the first part, and if there's time, maybe I'll ask the second part. But you mentioned a population of single men being segregated from the family camps, and you're talking a lot about the plight of women in the camps. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about these two populations of seemingly familyless singles. Are the men migrant workers? Are the women young? If you could just kind of flesh that out a little bit, I'm really curious to know.
So the population of single working age men in San Francisco is nothing new, right? It starts with the gold rush. And so in the period of the disaster, everyone's displaced. But when you think about rebuilding and work, the group of single working men are the ones most likely to have employment immediately after the disaster. And actually, San Francisco attracted workers from elsewhere to come in and work. And the problem for them was the high cost of housing, which is why they were in relief camps. And I talk in the book a little bit about the story of some of the working class families and single men who are south of Market and have nowhere to go. They get on Mission Road, which is now Mission Street. They get on Mission Road. They keep walking. They walk all the way out to Daly's farm pasture. That's now Daly City. He was a milk magnate in the city at the time. They camp out there, and the location's convenient because they can camp out. They're sort of outside this relief system that I describe because the men can walk down to Mission Road, get a trolley, and get back downtown for rebuilding work. And so they actually thrive and do well, but what they find when the city rebuilds, they did not rebuild a place for them in South of Market. They end up staying on Daly's pasture farm and then creating Daly City, which is a working class town at the time. And then the single women, I focus in this talk about older single women, right, who don't have children or extended families. There also was a very active debate about the younger single women who were not returning to work as housemaids and cooks. And so there was a big push in the newspapers and by relief leaders of these women should not be in the relief camps. They needed to go back to their employment. So there, that was part of the camp life, too.
You talk a lot about what happened in the months following the earthquake, but in the days following the earthquake, the first 72 hours or week, what does your research show about people coming together across social classes to help one another? And related to that, there is a theory about whether looting is widespread or not. Yeah. So I wonder what the historical data that you found showed about those issues.
So to respond to the first part of your question about do people come together in the immediate aftermath, absolutely they do. But what I find is that when you're panicked, I don't know, don't think about losing your car keys and you have an important meeting, but just think about something big goes wrong, you turn to what you know. So the people in San Francisco, they're immediate in the blind panic. They're walking towards a relative's house. They're walking somewhere where they know someone. So even though I found altruism, the people were very helpful. There's a man in Noe Valley who, for no reason, he didn't know anyone, opened his home for anyone to come sleep, and he had women sleeping and girls sleeping 4 to 5 in a bed long ways to fit. But who he was housing were folks from South of Market who knew people, their relatives, in the Mission District. So people are already flowing in the networks that they know. The Chinese refugees that I follow, they don't blindly go anywhere. They go to former employers. They go to Chinese fishing and shrimp camps. They go to places where they're known and can be visible. So there is altruism, but I still find that it's within these social networks that existed before and then become strengthened afterwards. And it's part of what makes the city more, I find, divisive in the long run. The looting, so I spent some time looking into that, and I believe from my research it was exaggerated. So there were accounts of looting, but I think when I think about maybe a good analogy would be Hurricane Katrina, of just, yes, it occurred, but it's taken out of social context even at the time. And in the few newspaper accounts that I found, stories of looking, and of course what I look to triangulate. If something's in the newspaper, I want to find it more than one newspaper. If it's in a newspaper, I'd like to find it in someone's personal account. If it's a newspaper in someone's personal account, I would like to find it in something someone saved. And so I have more than one sources corroborating that this is something that maybe it could have happened once, but it's more widespread, and I didn't find that. And part of the tip-off for me was repeated stories of the same, it sounds like an urban legend, you know, of a woman's fingers being cut off to get the rings, like, I read that one too many times and not corroborated anywhere else.
You mentioned the number of casualties estimated at approximately 3,000.
Yeah.
Do you find any evidence of distortion of that data by the media or politicians or leaders of that time?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and it's sort of a reverse distortion. So at the time, the public reports on deaths in San Francisco never tallied more than 400. And that tally existed unchecked, unquestioned, for decades. And only recently, if you don't know the name Gladys Hansen, she's just fabulous. She's a former city librarian here in San Francisco, and she runs the SF Virtual Museum. And some of the images in my book are from her archive. So Gladys Hansen, in response to just people walking into the public library saying, did my relatives live? Did they die? What happened? She started doing the research. So she can document with addresses, death certificates, birth certificates. She documented 3,000. It's likely so much higher. She thinks around 10,000 minimum, but we can't document it. And part of it is you think about San Francisco at the time, a city of 410,000, that was the 1900 census. So many of those workers are temporary. They're coming in on ships and they're on the docks. They're in boarding houses along the waterfront. Chinatown has never been reported accurately in the census data. So with that inferno, those pictures that I showed you, with the inferno raging and so many of the city's residents undocumented in a way, it's hard to imagine how many died. But 3,000 surely seems like a small number to me.
Can you discuss how class distinctions played out in the Mission District in terms of the relief effort?
Yeah, no, the Mission District is an interesting place at the time. And so it's a mixture. It's definitely not as working class and poor as South of Market. It's more families, but families are sharing. If they own a home, they're sharing that space. Unlike Western Addition, where a family might own their own home and be able to afford servants. The Mission District always has, James Phelan lives in the Mission District. Some single professional men who work downtown are living in the Mission District, so they're saving up to have a family. So it's a mixture of a community. But what I find it interesting is that I know there's ties between Mission District families and South of Market. So a lot of folks leaving South of Market come through the Mission and keep walking to Daly City, or what will be Daly City, but they stop in the Mission District because they know someone. And there's a big relief camp in what's now Dolores Park. So in general, I found the Mission District to be this really interesting community where first they responded to fighting the fires. That's in my book a little bit. You know, the Golden Hydrant is a Golden Hydrant for a reason, but the Working Hydrant on 20th and Dolores, and it wasn't the fire department that ran that hydrant. It was community members noticing it worked, getting the word out, and getting the water distributed. So they worked in unison to stop the fires, and then they were very receptive to refugees coming into their neighborhood. Unlike other cities and towns where you can read newspaper articles where they're alarmed that South of Market, poor refugees are invading Sausalito, right, or San Rafael, or even Oakland and Berkeley.
Yes, regarding the relief money, was money available to the working classes to rebuild their homes? I mean, we know a lot of money came from all over the country, but I wonder, were there people who couldn't rebuild because they had no access to funds?
Well, the whole relief, and I'm looking at the time, so I won't answer this in length, but the whole question of disaster relief, what was the policy, how did they execute it, and what happened, that's a big part of my book. It's so interesting because this kind of policy did not exist prior, and they really were inventing and on the ground. So what's unusual here is when I mentioned the $9.5 million in relief dollars, that was unprecedented. But it really was for disaster relief and distributed through this policy. So new forms, new regulations. I mean, I have letters of some women just asking for help on how to even fill out a form. So to get your hands on the $9.5 million for rebuilding, that was not neighborhood-based. That was through a relief system where you had to apply for the funds. And it could be to rebuild your home, rebuild your business, or even just some furniture money to restock the supplies that were lost in your home. Oh, gosh, do I have an economist in the room for my today's dollars? Does she get the second half of your question? Okay.
Hooray. So as I understand it, much of the single room occupancy hotel stock in San Francisco was built shortly after the 1906 earthquake to house a lot of these young men laborers, mm-hmm. Especially in Soma and Tenderloin, I guess. And so what I was wondering is what kind of housing was in those neighborhoods before, and where were those men living before?
So you need to read my book. It's so good. Okay. So South of Market had housing for single men, boarding houses, single resident occupancy hotel, and they had a lot of single family flats. So when it went to rebuild, what returned were, there was more of a nice map of the Sanborn map in my book, but what returned was less housing for families, but an equal amount of housing or equivalent housing for single men. And that attracted new workers coming in, as well as the men returning who lost their home. So why, where that shifts as a neighborhood is, it's not a family place anymore. It's either warehouses, businesses, or it's a place for working single men.
We have time for a couple more questions.
There used to be, I think, a couple of the refugee shacks that still existed at least 10 years ago or so, but they were obviously expanded considerably since that time. But if you knew where to look, you would recognize the original structure. Do you know if those still exist?
Yeah. So the so you saw the picture of a shack on a horse wagon. So that was, they were transported like that all around the city. And some refugees, either that was their only home, or they get two or three and they put them together, or they had one and they built onto it. And there's a really great nonprofit, I think it's called Outside Lands, that worked on a campaign to save the remaining refugee shacks. Some exist as homes that have been added onto. Some are standalone. But they had a campaign a few years ago to save the shacks. And so they have a nice website where they can give you a map of where those houses are in the city.
This is a comment to the last one. There is a refugee shack at Randall Museum that you can walk inside.
Yeah.
And I've been inside another one, but I can't remember what it was. At the Presidio. Yeah. There's two places.
Yeah.
Time for one last question.
Let's say $230 million today. 9.5
million. Oh, thank you.
Thanks to Google.
Yeah. Either an economist or Google in a room, right?
Well, this obviously is a nice way to compare it to the Oakland fire from 15 years ago or so, when the houses burned down and people built even bigger ones with the money that they received for disaster relief. Something changed over those 100 years. Any last question? Anybody want to ask him one more question?
There's somebody.
Do you want to answer it? Okay.
I'm afraid this might be a little out of context, but I just moved to San Francisco 6 months ago, and I'm just learning about the city and the earthquake and all of this. But I have this wonderful view of the Coit Tower, and it's a memorial for the firemen of that time, is my understanding, and it's a very reverent place. And I would, if you know anything about the woman that was responsible for it, I'd be curious to know more.
Oh, I'm trying to think that, maybe I'll turn to my friend for help. But Lily Hitchcock. So she was a fan of the firefighters. I think she traveled around with the firefighters. And so she dedicated that monument to them. And I'm trying to think of the dates that But I'm trying to think of the dates of her lifespan to think of when she was traveling around with the firefighters in the city.
There's a lot of myths about that one.
Yeah.
Which we won't go into.
Okay.
But what I had heard when I moved here was that she was a sea captain's wife, a widow, a young widow, something like that. And the rest of the story should be clear.
Yeah.
So, thank you very much, Andrea.
Thank you.
Now you have more fans in addition to your one big fan, right?
Yeah.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 109th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much. Books are for sale right out here if you'd like to have a copy with all the details.
I think, not everyone here is going to buy a book. Like, they might, like Estelle brought her own book. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that
was good?
Great.
Okay.
That was wonderful.
That was really
fun.
Yeah.
Could you stay awake?
Yeah. You did a good job.
Barely, yeah.
She rewrote my last line, so I was smiling when looked at you. Yeah? Yeah.
I'll go turn it off.
In the company or the country.
Well, you know, it's really interesting you said that, because there was an 11th point
on my 10-point plan. And that 11th point was the fact that we need to have a presidential line item veto, okay? Because entitlements today account for roughly 63% of our fiscal budget. It's very difficult as a former CEO for me to step into, in a best understanding, how I'm going to guide any enterprise a given next year when my budget's already been filled by 63% of said. Yeah. And so the thing is it is inflation here? Absolute, without a doubt. I mean, if you're in Omaha this past weekend, you know, Mr. Buffett most certainly said that inflation's here. Many others have ascribed to the fact that inflation's here. I say that inflation's right around the corner. The one thing that we've got to be careful about is the fact that inflation by itself, we can manage. A stagnating economy, which lends itself to stagflation, which took place in the 70s when I was at the Fed, is ever more difficult proposition.
Yeah, if confidence is such a huge component of economic activity overall, what would you say to the retail investor, let's say, who, you know, more and more are starting to feel as though they've been sold a bill of goods with respect to stocks for the long run? And then just a greater comment on confidence overall when you think about, you know, consumers looking at their own balance sheets, not seeing nearly as much there as was there 2 years ago, then being asked to go out and spend and have confidence, 8-alarm fire versus being trained for a 4-alarm, you know, is, with respect to a decline in confidence, is that already in the fire? Or, you know, what can be done to repair that?
And perhaps the thing that I've been saying is that confidence is dynamic. You can gain it, you can build it just as easily as you can lose it. Yeah. I think the thing is that we're at a point where confidence is so precarious. I think in times of precariousness, I think it's best exemplified by the fact that you've seen recently our savings rates increase, you know, tremendously. And so the correlative to that is the fact that consumptive behavior really has decreased considerably. The thing is that there is a point between excess of consumption and the fact of mainstay consumption, okay, or consumption by itself. I think the thing is that we're going to get back to a point where historically, in such periods, people will inevitably lose optimism. Pessimism will gain, and that's ever more it's a fight. That's why I'm encouraging each and every one of you. You've got to go on out there. You've got to figure out what's going on. You've got to best determine the fact you want to be optimistic. Okay? There's a price level in answering your question in which a new General Motors car is going to make sense to you. I don't know what that is, but you know what? Don't be stricken by fear in itself.
Patrick, I want to talk to you. Have you talk a little bit about inflation? We touched on it a couple of questions back. The slide that caught my eye was almost $3 trillion pumped in the economy. So at this moment, we have too many dollars chasing too few goods. That's our definition of inflation. At the same time, William Seedman, you know, a distinguished former FDIC chairman, said the other day on CNBC, he thinks it might be different this time around. What do you see in terms of timing for inflation? It seems like you do see inflation. What do you see in terms of timing?
I do see inflation. And I think the thing is that there is, in a nutshell, I don't see inflation really picking up until mid-year of next year in any, you know, defined, in an excessive defined manner. I think the thing is that we are in a period of deflation today where we will transcend this period of deflationary pressure on assets. And still, we've got a way to go before that. But it is right around the corner.
Patrick, we've come to that point, unfortunately, and I know there are other questions, and I'm sure that people would enjoy continuing to talk about this, and want to thank you very much for your insightful remarks tonight. I'd like to leave you a couple of minutes to highlight and recap of some of the things you'd like us to leave with tonight. You've emphasized us going out there and kind of trying to figure it out and remain optimistic and so forth, but please leave us with some thoughts that you'd like us to go and ponder.
Tom, thanks. You know, as an order, the last thing you want is an opportunity as such to be able to leave a lasting impression on each and every one of you. I think the lasting impression I want to leave with you is the fact that do not become pessimistic. Remain optimistic. The path to optimism is really through knowledge. The odyssey to optimism is really gained from understanding what not to be pessimistic about, or what to gain in terms of being optimistic about. Okay. And that's what I'm saying. Thank you.
And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.